Session number 11945, row 7.
Claxton, Reel 7.
Anyway, Mr. Garnish decided to give me a start. And I worked there from 1930 right through to the end of this last World War, with the exception of 8 weeks when they were suddenly went quiet. So the warehouse was full up with the oxygen equipment. And the first year I was there, they made a profit of £750,000, and they thought they were the tops.
Did you find it difficult to go back to civilian life?
Not really.
Can I take you back a long way then to, which we started talking about the convoys up to Lerwick from Immingham. When you set off with a convoy, you said there were three of you, and you'd be escorting a convoy with about 20 merchant ships. What sort of formation did you...
Well, there's the leader of the convoy in front. There's one behind, one at the rear, and to urge on the straggler, because the speed of the convoy is decided by the slowest ship. And normally it's one boat run at the back and one on the beam, nearest side to enemy territory.
So you'd be on the seaward side then, rather than the coast side?
That's right. Up there in that particular instance. I mean, going across the Atlantic be another kettle of fish, because it's all sea. But that was the usual way. What sort of ship would be a... It might be a trawler, seagoing trawler. They were armed in there, armed with a 3-inch gun or something like that, you see, and they're not very heavily armed. But that was a usual formation, because in the boat around those three would be all the ships, you see. And I remember once we come... It was trouble. One boat got torpedoed, and when we got up to it, it was waterlogged, just floating along on the surface. The upper deck was level with the water. In fact, it was a question of whether it was going to sink or not. Anyway, us three ships, one towing, and one ship he had to side, or he was on. The boat I was on then was, the Liffey, I think. Anyway, we was one side, the seagoing trawler was the other, and the destroyer in the front towing up. And we beached her ashore between up from Flamborough Head northward, somewhere up there, maybe around Scarborough way, I don't know for now. But anyway, we managed to beach her, that was the point. And of course, we thought we were on a good thing. Salvage money. Oh, lovely. We weren't. We didn't get a penny because the ship was, it was chartered by the Admiralty. And to all intents and purposes, a government ship, but not. Had it been a private concern, we was okay, but we weren't. And the main cargo of that ship was boots, footwear. And the footwear was packed. We're going to have some of these. If you took a case full of boots, you'd take the case full of riot boots. The other case is all left boots. So you'd, that's how they're packed now in any case. But anyway, that's boy. What I do remember about that was some of the crew went on board, you know, to assist in the towing and that, aboard the merchant ship. And I said to the skipper, can I go aboard? He said, what do you want to go aboard for? I said, have a look at the wireless, see what's happening in the wireless room. The ship had been abandoned, you see, and it's just us there. Well, I went. The wireless room was on the upper deck, and I went in the wireless room. And I went foraging round. There was a cupboard there, like that door, say, like that door there, and I opened it, and I put my hand in. The door was jammed a bit, and I put my hand in there, and I remember if it was today, I put my hand on something soft and warm, about 4 foot up. What the hell am I touching now? Soft and warm. And when I did eventually open the door, it was a flipping collar of a fur coat. Whoever owned the ship, I don't know. They'd abandoned, the ship was abandoned. But anyway, we did get her ashore. We did get it beached. So that.
What was the wireless equipment like on the merchantman?
Oh, primitive, really. I mean, everything was primitive. It was more or less cat whisker days then.
Was it the same sort of things you'd got on the
ship? Yes, Yeah. There was no valves in those days. Valve was out. You relied on for a cat's whisker and with a cat's whisker and the material, the crystal you used was either bornite, tellurium. There was two of them: bornite, tellurium, carborundum. How it worked, I haven't a clue. All I know is in the, it used to be marvellous to hear anything. There was no radio like wireless or talking. No talking then. It was all Morse. It was all the Morse code.
When the convoy at these convoy sales, did the merchant ships generally manage to keep station and follow discipline well?
Yes, more or less. More or less. As I say, if one broke down, well, it was just a bit of, but if there weren't enough ships, escort ships, well, she just had to take her chance. The others had to go on.
When you came back on a return journey from Lerwick, were you also doing escort? Or
yeah, bringing ship back, escorting ships back.
So it's a regular routine.
Regular
right
back
and
forwards, monotonous, no variation at all, except a coal ship. And then every 6 months or more, you would do for dock, boiler cleaning and all that sort of thing, and you got leave. And we used to go up to St George's Dock in Hull. Yeah, St George's Dock in Hull we used to go to. But the HMS Patrol, the guard ship, or she stopped there all the time. She never went to sea until, as I say, she was taken off that job and they sent her to Queenstown. The only time she went to sea between 1914 and 1914 and about the end of 16 was when she took part. She went to the assistance of when the Germans shelled Hartlepool and Scarborough. She went to sea to try and help. I wasn't there then, but that was the only time she went to sea. Other than that, she was tied up alongside the jetty at Immingham. And then from there, she go up to Hull for boiler cleaning and that, because she was under steam all the time.
You said that the convoys formed up outside. Did they form up in the estuary, or was it beyond the estuary?
No, in the estuary. In the estuary. Just the same. Well, some would be outside, but sort of in a protected area while they all mustered up.
How was the protected area protected?
By the ships. By the ships.
Were there any fixed defences on the way
no,
in?
No, not going out, no.
Because it's a big estuary, isn't it?
Yes, oh, it's a big estuary, but it's got to be navigable, you see. I mean, because you can see water, so you can sail the battleship up there, it's got to go through a channel. That's the whole idea of pilot, isn't it?
On this 12 months or so of convoy duty, did you ever have any encounters with enemy forces or any?
None at all.
No submarine alarms?
None at all. It was just there and back. Never bothered us. Their main thing was to get the enemy submarines was to get onto the Irish Sea and into the Atlantic. That's where their hive. That's where their harvest was there. Yeah.
You said that you went off to the patrol at Queenstown. How did you get to the patrol when it was at Queenstown?
By rail to either Holyhead, I think it was lower down, across to Roslair. Across to Roslair by ferry, and then across by rail to Queenstown. When I was sent back from the patrol back to Chatham Barracks, we came up to cross country to Dublin, and then on the ferry to Holyhead and back down by rail. And why I remember that so well is that when I was in the train crossing Ireland, flipping Irishman, it was two or three of us on there. He said, "You're not in King's Country now, you know." No? He said, "No, it's Queen's County, this is." I forget what the county was. Anyway, it was referring to the fact that it wasn't King's Country, it was Queen's Country or something. It was the name of it. I remember that well. But they were friendly then, up to a point. In Queenstown, there's an island there called Spike Island. It's now a holiday centre. It used to be an ammunition depot when I was there. And it used to be the base for training, training ships. That was the first place I went as a boy when I went to sea. Plymouth, in January 1914, was sent aboard HMS Crescent. From there we travelled to Queenstown for training. Sick as a dog. Sick. And there from there you did your sea training. Round to Bantry Bay, firing practice, all that sort of thing, target practice. You had any job. I was a seaman boy then. And then we went right up north round Scotland Way and eventually come back to Queenstown. But your seagoing training usually took about 4 months. And you were put through the hammer then, good and proper. But if you liked it, you could ride over it, and we were well fed.
You're saying that when you were at Queenstown on the Sprightly, you were doing anti-submarine patrols.
Yes.
Was that independent of convoy escort, or were you?
Oh yes, absolutely. We were just definitely simply on submarine patrol, and because also remember that there's the steamers going backwards and forwards. To Holyhead and from Holyhead, Dublin.
So where did these patrols actually take place? What area were you patrolling?
In the RSG, in a sort of a box, which you can say there's Holyhead, there's Dublin. We was in a box around there. That was our area. Then further down, from Wales, around that way, be some more. Patrolling that sort. Anything coming down that they knew of, submarine coming down the Irish Sea, it should be passed on and on where it was expected it would be. Whether it was another matter.
Did you have any contacts with submarines?
Two or three, but whether all I do remember we had all come to the surface, but whether that was a decoy or not, we never knew.
So how many attacks were there then that you remember?
Well, in those days, this is on a small ship, you're ashore, you're away for 9 days at sea. You've run out of bread. You want the biscuits. You've no refrigeration then. You run out of meat. Fish, you run out of fish. Used to be salt. So if you want fish for on the menu, drop a couple of depth charges down, you get loads of fish. In the book, in the log, it would be attacked. Unknown, but until you got your meals. Oh, you're getting wonderful fish. You'd be surprised what come to the surface, stunned, lower a boat and gather it in. But in the main, you were on the alert. You never knew whether it was us or them, but because with that blimp up top, they could see more than we could see.
I was going to ask you about the blimp, about the limitations on its use. Presumably it couldn't operate in really foul weather.
Oh, no, couldn't operate. No. Today it'd be ideal for it.
So it's a day with a little bit of cloud.
Cloud and very little wind, you see.
How did the blimp move itself? What was its system of power?
Motor, electric, petrol. Motor. Same as a Zeppelin. And it's just a small version.
What sort of height would it be at normally when it was observing for you?
500 feet, yeah.
So it'd just be a team of your destroyer and the blimp?
That's right, yeah. There was only one destroyer and the blimp. Mind you, that blimp had served more than one destroyer, because when we were in, there would be another destroyer out. So that it was in use all the time. Carrier of two. And towards the end of the war, America come into the war, then the American MTBs came over to help us.
You saw them?
Yes, we saw them. And that was the first time that I can ever remember hearing talking on wireless. Talking between themselves. God, what are we hearing now? And then, toward the end of the war, the wireless side of the business was improving all the time.
So you mentioned the continuous wave.
Yes.
You went on the course at Chatham.
That's right. Yeah. That's valve transmission. Now, this is a bit slightly technical. Valve transmission, the sound is on one wave all the time. Now, to alter that, they alter the wavelength. They don't stop. You don't get in the Morse code, da, stop, dit, da, dit, da, 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 da. This is one continuous wave all the time, continuous wave being continually altered in wavelength. And by altering wavelength, you're tuned into one wavelength. Well, directly they alter the wavelength for a second, you miss it. So you get your dash dot of the Morse code. And that's what it was called, continuous wave. Okay. But now, well, of course, there's no Morse code now. I don't know what happens now.
What? How long did your course take when you're trained on continuous wave?
It wasn't exactly a course. It was putting you in the picture as to the upkeep of the thing. I mean, you already knew. You're already a wireless operator. It's just a different technique, known a different technique of how it's the Morse code is transmitted. I mean, in the old days, what they called spark transmission, you pressed your key. And the spark for the ark. It's like atmospherics. It's a sort of a controlled atmospheric in a small scale. When you press your key, the electricity jumps between two points. Directly you lift your key up, you cut the electricity off, direct to man, and that was known as spark transmission. And of course, the bigger the set, the bigger the arc, the bigger the distance. The bigger the longer the distance you could transmit. But I think the original form of transmission was what was known as a Rumkopf coil. Now, we can't explain it more than that, except the name. But as I say, it was all.
But was the continuous wave a more reliable means of transmission?
Oh yes, definitely yes. While those valves were emitting all the light, and it was a different sound altogether. Instead of a harsh spark, it was a sort of a toony sound, a tinny musical sound. Da-da-da-da. That sort of thing. It said, da-da-da-da. Very funny. The first time I listened into a transmission on spark was in the Mediterranean. And we was picking up press message from Pole 2 in Cornwall on spark transmission, which on a cat's whisker, which was a marvellous thing.
It's a long distance.
Yeah, distance and that. But also, out in China, it was out in China on the Vindictive, we had a chief petty officer there, lived at Walthamstow, named Bull, Johnny Bull. He's a nice fella, he was. I also lived at Walthamstow then, but anyway, Johnny Bull, poor old chap, passing on now. If he's not, he must be on. He's over 100. But anyway, he was everlasting probing into the possibilities. And he designed and made a shortwave receiver, and it worked. But things were so sensitive in those days that if you put your hand near it, you got microphonic noises. Woo! So, piece of ebonite rod about that, so I was joined on the set, and there was his hand turning it. But it worked, because I could remember, I was on the watch at the midnight, at the midnight watch, 12 to 4, and it picked up. Night time was the best time for why I don't know, but anyway, it was midnight in the middle watch, as we called it. I picked up the Admiralty on shortwave. I jumped out to drop the boat. I went after Johnny Bull, chucked him out of his hammock. He couldn't believe it. And then it lasted about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, this transmission, and it faded. And after that, because he built on it, but he was very, very good. And I remember another time he went into the cage and he touched the wrong one. He had about 20,000 volts he picked up. It shot him on his backside. The transmission side was kept in a cage, huge, great cage, because the coils then, the induction coils are damn great things then. But anyway, it was so the cage, this cage I'm speaking of, was about 6 foot by four.
Was this a sort of Faraday cage?
Yeah, a netting.
Wire netting.
Wire netting. Stop you getting at the transmitters. while it's in use, because it's alive. Anyway, when you open the door to go into the cage, you automatically break the circuit. But he was in there and he wanted the door shut because he wanted to find something out while it was alive. And he shut the door. And he touched the wrong thing. Boy, it shot him on his backside. Poor old man. He got over it. He got over it. It's the amperes that kill you, not the voltage. The voltage, the amperes is the current. The voltage is the pressure that pushes it through.
Did you have to do a lot of maintenance and repair on your sets?
No, no.
Was that part of your duties to do those things if they were necessary?
No. Another thing on the Vindictive, because this one talked about 1927 now, 27-28. Well, all the time we was out on the China station, we were sort of spying on the Japanese. All their transmission we picked up. Now, the Japanese code is different to ours. In the, our Morse code is dida, you know, I is dida, and so on. Japanese is different. It's a different code altogether, but it's a code like similar to the Morse code, but you have to relearn it so you know what you're picking up. Well, you get about four wireless ratings and they're trained. They've got to forget. You've got to forget you know the English language, you've got to know the French. We'll say you've got to learn French so that you know both. You can go from one to the other. And they're on that 24 hours a day. Now, we had one or two lectures over that, and whoever it was who told us, we were told by this person who came to give us a talk on it, the reason for this, trying to find out different things. For instance, if you received a message, say, from a Japanese destroyer that so-and-so was ill, reporting to his own headquarters, so-and-so had come down or there was an illness or infection on board, the people here, at home here, were trying to sort out why. Maybe the water system aboard or something like that. And he said, you think it's nothing. We think it's a lot. And you, all we ask you to do is to take the message and we'll leave the rest to us. Well, before a fellow became proficient on that, we used to take it on a old-fashioned coil, like a... You remember the old gramophones that used to have a cylindrical record? Similar to that, a dictaphone.
So it was a wax disc.
Wax disc.
Mm. Or cylinder, yes.
Wax cylinder. When it's full up and you've got all the pickings out of it, you can then clean it off and start again. Dictaphone used to be in a big box about that square and about that high with the dictaphone on top, just like an old-fashioned gramophone, not with a horn, but with the needle in its box going along the bar as it turned. You do it that way. But we still not. That was 24 hours a day. Week in, week out, week in, week out. And I expect no doubt they did the same to us.
You were saying earlier on that the message announcing the armistice came in code.
Yes.
What sort of codes were they using?
What they call a peace code. It was known to us as a peace code. That's a four-letter code. It was in... You started writing it down four letters. Was A, B, C, D, that's four letters, A, B, C, D. That is the actual code. You never forget it. And to break that into the next line, You get did it. The next four letters, did it. Next four letters and so on. And you knew by the call sign who the message was for because each ship had its own call sign. But also, if it was a general that was from all ship it was from your own call sign. And then after that you know.